In England, we don't really have a national motto, but many other nations do. Switzerland's motto, I gather, is one for all for one. Not sure if they copied it from the Three Musketeers or the other way around. Wales, Wales forever. Scotland, well, they've got two ancient sovereigns' mottos, one of which, when translated from the Latin, is no one provokes me with impunity. Maybe that explains something about how the English and the Scots relate. And the motto of the United States, as some may know, in God we trust, which is included on every coin and banknote. It's a controversial motto because many see it as flying in the face of their constitution's separation of politics and religion. But whatever the rights and wrongs of it being their national motto, those words, in God we trust, represent a concise summary, well, of the message of the Bible as a whole and of Psalm 20 that we're looking at today in particular. The psalm seems to have been written in the first place to be used before an impending battle. Its opening five verses are a prayer for Israel's army, possibly focused on the king as he leads them. May the Lord answer you in the day of trouble. May the name of the God of Jacob protect you. May he send you help from the sanctuary, and so on. And then in the conclusion, verse 9 returns to prayer. O Lord, save the king. May he answer us when we call. In between those prayers, though, verses 6 to 8 are more in the way of statements of conviction and of faith. Verse 6, now I know that the Lord saves his anointed. He will answer him from his holy heaven and with saving might of his right hand. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. They collapse and fall, but we rise and stand upright. And it's verse 7 which we're going to particularly focus on this morning as it begins. Some trust in chariots and some in horses. We don't know exactly when the psalm was written, but for much of the period covered by the Old Testament, the horse and the chariot was the most powerful weapon of war that had been invented. A nation either needed to have its own technology to manufacture the chariots, or if it didn't, be fortunate enough to be able to buy them from a neighboring ally. Then, as now, horses were fast and fairly easily trained. What I hadn't realized until I checked things out, though, was that for quite a few centuries in that era, selective breeding of horses hadn't advanced enough to allow people to ride on horseback. And the way to make use of their speed was instead to build some kind of buggy or chariot for one of the horses to pull, which could provide a stable platform for one, two, perhaps three soldiers at times to be transported spear in hand rapidly towards the enemy. And so horses and chariots were, for a while, the ancient world's equivalent of the tank or the nuclear warhead. And you'd assume that would leave the nation that had managed to acquire appreciably bigger numbers of them than their foes a huge advantage in battle. Curiously, though, God's directions to his people in the book of Deuteronomy specifically forbade a future king from amassing horses. They weren't banned completely, but building up the kind of numbers to give a military advantage over other nations was forbidden. And in the period of the conquest of the Promised Land, even before there was a king to take responsibility for the nation's policy, this commandment seems to have been largely obeyed. The Israelites, as they crossed the River Jordan, would probably not have had many horses and almost certainly no chariots. Yet with God's help, they won the day against several peoples that did have them. The logical stance when victorious would have been to appropriate as much as possible as the defeated army's key weaponry. But, for example, later on in the story, 2 Samuel 8 tells how King David deliberately refrained from doing that, retaining only 100 horses for his own people's use, despite potentially being able to capture far more from their defeated opponents. His son, King Solomon, it's worth noting, wasn't so faithful in this regard, acquiring 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horses. And the reason why such an accumulation was prohibited, well, though it might be a mystery, it's not particularly explained in Deuteronomy. Psalm 20, though, gives the explanation. A nation with such superior equipment for conflict would almost inevitably put its trust in military might. Whereas the Lord's longing were for his people instead to trust in him, to see their prayers to him, not just as a ceremonial formality, but as the only thing which gave them any hope at all. So we might wonder, what lesson is there for us as a church or as individuals in our faith today? Needless to say, we aren't facing a military conflict, and even when a church is part of a nation where it believes it's conducting a just war against an aggressor, quite a bit of care may well be needed to how to apply this kind of text. In New Testament times and beyond, the people of God can never simply be identified with one nation or another. But as God's people, we are very clearly in another kind of battle. Ephesians tells us we're in a spiritual battle against the forces of evil. On the ground here in the 21st century, our West, our battle is against, well, occasionally downright opposition and hostility towards the Christian faith. Far more often, indifference and apathy towards Christ. And faced with such a challenge, Psalm 20 encourages us to ask ourselves where we put our trust. Some trust in chariots and some in horses. I guess for a church, the equivalent would be to have so much of the way in the way of accumulated resources that it imagined that winning people for Christ was simply a matter of expending those resources in the right direction. The right kind of publicity, the right kind of attractive events to put on, and inevitably people would be drawn not only to the church, but in time to Christ. And in some cultures, perhaps a church could be confident of numerical expansion simply by relying on applying its resources in the right direction to attract others. But there'd then be a real danger of neglecting to bring God into the equation. For any praying to be mere ceremonial window dressing when the church's real trust was in its plans and its programs. Maybe it's not a bad thing. We're not quite in that position. We thank God for the resources we have been given for a reasonably sound and useful church building, for a few reserves in the church bank account, for at the moment having three full-time members of staff and quite a few willing and able volunteers. But we're clearly deluding ourselves if we think that those resources on their own give any kind of recipe for success. Mission to the Westlands, as to most of the UK today, is far harder than that. And we mustn't fall into the trap of trusting in St. Andrew's small supplies of metaphorical chariots and horses. Instead, our trust must be in the Lord. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. A principle there to make us think carefully about what new directions a church embarks on. At one extreme, there'd be some who'd suggest that any alteration in a church's pattern represents a mistrust in our own plans. I'm not sure about that, because the exact details of church worship and church mission and church life that we've inherited aren't given as a blueprint in the pages of the Bible. They've been evolved by a previous generation and the ones before that as to what seemed to make sense for the mission of the church in their day. Some of those details and programs may still be very effective. Others, though, may benefit from significant alteration. It's possible to have an undue trust in a new idea as a recipe for success in itself. But as we try new things, like the slightly different pattern for Message Sunday next week that's spelled out in the notice sheet, our natural applications can, I believe, actually encourage a real prayer and a real trust in God. I'm reminded of the story of a man whose town was hit by a flood and who sat on his roof praying to God for help. He was offered a lift, first in a rowing boat, then a helicopter, and finally a lifeboat, but turned each one down, adamant that he was waiting for the Lord to save him. When sadly he drowned and reached heaven, he asked God for an explanation as to why there was no intervention, to which the reply came back, "Well, I sent you two boats and a helicopter. What more did you expect?" Trying new strategies, whether totally new or borrowed from other churches, may not represent a denial of our trust in God. At the same time, we need to be aware there are some new ideas or new directions that could conflict with a genuine dependence on the Lord. It's true, in each generation, the church has realized ways in which its understanding of the scriptures has been wrong. And there are times when what's taught clearly needs to be altered to correct our previous errors. All the same, changing our teaching simply to fit more comfortably with what the world around believes is a rather different matter. A century ago, Dean Ing warned, "Whoever marries the spirit of this age will find himself a widower in the next." And history proves that churches whose teaching has swum with the cultural tide have generally not had the mission success that they expected. So when people say the church's teaching has to move with the times or else our mission will be impossible, well, we need to think carefully about whether that could just represent a lack of trust in God and in the good news he's committed to us. These things can matter because working out what it does and doesn't mean to trust in the Lord isn't a minor detail. It's at the very heart of what it means to have faith in him. And the psalm points to the way in which we demonstrate that faith supremely by our commitment to prayer. As I said, the psalm starts and ends with prayer. And even in verse 7, well, the way it speaks of trusting in the name of the Lord points in that direction. Speaking of God's name partly reminds us of the blessing of having a God who's revealed himself to his people. A part of that revelation being his giving his name of Yahweh to his people in Old Testament times. As well as that, speaking of the name of the Lord reminds us of the privilege of being able to come to him by name in our prayers. If I'm honest, I don't know how many members of St. Andrew's are committed to praying earnestly for God, for him to be at work in our congregation and in our area, in our mission. A good proportion of those who are brought up to pray may, in some cases I reckon, have significantly more of a focus in our praying on our family's welfare and blessing. Now that's certainly allowed, encouraged even, in the Bible. But not so that it becomes the main aim or the exclusive focus of our prayers. We need to pray to express our trust in God in the battles that we face, to live for him for individuals, and to seek to win the world through the mission of his church. Tomorrow evening, as was mentioned in the notices, is our monthly prayer meeting. And it's great to have a small but regular group of people who come along. Good too that a number of others in recent months have at times joined in. I think it's important, though, that as a church, more people try to come to that meeting, to make prayer a priority in that way, as a means of expressing our trust in God as a congregation, of showing to him and to the world that we really believe that it's the work of his Spirit that will make a difference in our mission rather than our efforts and our plans on their own. Of making a way of making clear that while some trust in chariots and some in horses, our trust is very firmly in the name of the Lord our God. Amen.
Standing back, we're going to have blue service focus and from